Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. President-elect Donald Trump has named former Long Island Congressman Lee Zeldin to lead the Environmental Protection Agency in his upcoming administration. New York environmental advocates and others are tempering their expectations as to how Zeldin's leadership might affect the regional environment. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley with more.
Scenic Hudson Executive Director of Policy, Advocacy, and Science Pete Lopez says the appointment of Zeldin to the EPA makes sense to him after working with him in the state legislature and when he was the EPA Region 2 Administrator while Zeldin was in Congress.
He understands New York. My sense is that he has awareness and sensitivity to the region from a very broad perspective.
Protect the Adirondacks Executive Director Peter Bauer expects a very difficult time ahead.
I expect Lee Zeldin to be very zealous in gutting the Environmental Protection Agency. I don't think that since the EPA has been around over the last 50 years, I don't think we have ever encountered a leader of that agency who will be so strongly at odds with its historic mission and wants to completely change its role in public policy and environmental policy. I think the combination of Zeldin and Trump is very worrying on a lot of levels.
At the Adirondack Council, spokesman John Sheehan says the nomination gives them some concerns, but they want to keep an open mind.
The fact that he is from New York makes us hopeful that he will understand some of the issues facing the Adirondacks. While we haven't always agreed in the past in terms of policy issues, I think there is an opportunity for access and for conversation to take place that could benefit the Adirondacks long term. But ultimately, I think we want to do everything we can to keep things from moving backwards in terms of environmental protection and public health. And we're going to have some work to do in the years ahead.
New York State Conservative Party Chair Jerry Kasar is delighted that Zeldin will lead the EPA, calling it a well-deserved appointment after Zeldin's near miss in the 2022 gubernatorial race.
He has a real background in environmental issues. Coming from Eastern Long Island, that should come as no surprise, but he has a balanced approach that respects the need for the economics of this country with the environmental needs. We believe the country is overregulated, particularly as it affects some of the oil industry and some of the auto industry, as well as some of the just general business regulations that do not necessarily follow the science. And we think Lee understands that, and he will be a perfect EPA administrator for the Conservative Party.
Meanwhile, Adirondack Wild Friends of the Forest Preserve managing partner David Gibson feels Zeldin is being appointed to the post due to loyalty and sees it as a signal that the White House will expect appointees to toe the line.
Former Congressman Zeldin is a loyalist, and I think that's the criteria that's prime top of mind on all of the nominees that Trump is making. Now, Mr. Zeldin may prove to be an independent administrator as much as he can. That's certainly possible, but I'm not expecting it.
Lopez reminds anyone who is concerned about potential Trump administration environmental policies that New York State has the ability to set more stringent standards.
Whatever the federal regulatory and statutory framework looks like moving forward, that the state does have the ability to set its own standards that are more stringent than federal. So that is a power that New York State and other states have.
Zeldin was the second New Yorker to be nominated to a position in the incoming Trump administration. New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik of the 21st District was tapped as UN ambassador.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
with New York Congresswoman Elise Stefanik tapped to serve as President-elect Donald Trump's U.N. ambassador, potential candidates to replace her are emerging. As the Legislative Gazette's Aaron Schiller Levine reports, a Montgomery County businessman is weighing a run.
Stefanik's 21st district encompasses 15 counties across northern New York. She easily won re-election, and local officials are beginning to brainstorm about candidates to fill the seat once she's confirmed. Saratoga County Republican Committee Chair Joe Serrata says it's too early to begin listing names.
Yes, we don't know the timeline at which she will depart. And then we do know that the public officers law has the governor calling an election. This is not a post that can be filled by appointment. So we expect within 80 to 90 days from that point which she resigns to have an election. But right now we don't have candidates that have come forward. I think everyone is keeping their powder dry.
The list of potential candidates to run for the seat is growing. Reports have named Republican State Senator Dan Steck of the 45th District, Congressman Mark Molinaro, who has not yet conceded a tight race for re-election in the 19th District, and Rensselaer County Executive Steve McLaughlin. State Assemblyman Chris Tague of the 102nd District said he would consider a bid, while Democrat Paula Collins, who just lost to Stefanik, wants to be considered by Democratic Party leaders. Republican Fulton County Election Commissioner William Eschler says he hasn't heard from anyone in his district who wants to run for the seat. He does, however, have an idea of what an ideal candidate might look like.
Somebody that's, you know, been in the area as far as, you know, some experience, certainly. A senator, perhaps, in one of the districts, or assemblyman, something of that nature, you know, probably would have a little bit easier task as far as, you know, not only knowing more of the area, knowing more of the people, but as far as, you know, would already have a campaign structure.
Serrata says it's still early without a list of confirmed potential candidates, but he expects county party leaders to have solid choices.
I do believe that there will be a lot of vetting going on at the higher levels, because I suspect that the president will want somebody who is going to fulfill his agenda while in office. I bet he's not looking for another Cheney or Kinziger. So this is all going to be important to the Congressional Campaign Committee, Elise, and President Trump.
Anthony Constantino, CEO of the Amsterdam-based company Sticker Mule, made local headlines as an outspoken Trump supporter this year, including installing a 100-foot-wide Vote for Trump sign on a city warehouse. He says he's considering a run for the seat and was inspired by Trump's journey into politics.
If I get involved and help inspire the country in a great way, I'm strongly considering doing that. I'm going to get dinner at Mar-a-Lago tonight with some interesting people, and they're going to give me their thoughts on the situation. But really, I want to just be helpful and do interesting and impactful things. That's been my way of operating. That's how I built my company. I always just try to do whatever is the biggest and most interesting and impactful thing I can do to help people and make the world a better and more interesting place.
If he does decide to commit to a campaign for the post, Constantino says he'd have his priorities straight.
So I said, like, this problem of the anti-Trump hate was a huge problem, and I went full speed ahead trying to fix that, and I think I did a pretty good job of addressing it and reducing it dramatically in the United States. I think the biggest problem in the United States, in New York right now, is people have been leaving, and we need to get people coming back. So I don't think anyone would be better than me at getting people to come back to New York State. That's the number one problem. The other politicians haven't even really identified that as New York State's number one problem.
Republican State Senator Jim Tedisco and Democratic Assemblyman Angelo Santabarbara have introduced a bill that would establish a state commission to examine New York's declining population. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Aaron Schello Levine.
Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with New York State Assembly Minority Leader William Barclay, just as news was breaking that Governor Kathy Hochul was reviving the congestion pricing plan for New York City. Barclay was not pleased with the news.
Well, first First of all, we oppose any congestion plan, whether it's a $15 one or it's $9 one. I think it's a wrong direction for New York. You know, one of the big issues, now getting right back on election, was the cost of living. And one of the reasons Donald Trump, I believe, became president was because he was able to effectively argue that the Biden administration policies were causing people to not be able to afford, you know, basic things like food, housing, and heating. And I think that was a very effective argument for him. So the fact now that the governor, right after the election, is now going back to increase tolls or put tolls on average New Yorkers seems amazing to me. I don't think the lesson was learned. And actually, what changed for the time when she proposed and then withdrew it and now is putting it back out, what changed when we had elections? Clearly, she realized before the election this was not a politically popular issue to be supporting. So she pulled it back, and now after the election, she's putting it back out there. What happened to her concern that she said when she initially withdrew it about the little guy and having the little guy be able to afford this? I don't know what's changed with that. Well, we only have 3 elections over, and we have a new president-elect. So, you know, I think it's going to be a very hard sell for her politically to get this done. I think there's a multiple groups, bipartisan groups, that are opposed to it. And really the problem I have ultimately with this, David, is the fact that the MTA is really a bloated bureaucracy. And just to there was a study done just to construct a mile of subway, you know, they're talking about the Second Avenue subway doing that. It's something like $4 billion for the MTA to do it. But anywhere else, it's on average, they can do a mile of track for about $350 million. So I think it's time, instead of trying to start a new program to raise revenue from the MTA, it's time to look internally at the MTA, see where the inefficiencies, that there must be god-awful inefficiencies in that bureaucracy, and look at that instead of trying just to create a new program that's going to end up costing the average New Yorkers money.
Well, obviously, with the majorities of Democrats in the legislature, you don't see them actually doing that, do you? Or even in New York City?
Well, again, it's now hard because the election's over. But clearly, there was a lot of pressure not to go through with this program initially because they knew how politically unpopular it was. And just because the election's over doesn't mean we're not going to have an election in 2 years, particularly for governor. So I do think there is some political liability of trying to push this through, and hopefully, you're right. It's going to be difficult to stop it in the legislature. They're the ones that passed it in the first place. But you know, with the outcry being as loud as it has been, maybe there is some political pressure, and maybe we can get it taken out. But who knows? We're going to do everything we can, at least in our conference, to voice our concerns about this and make sure that New Yorkers know what's being proposed.
That's New York State Assembly Minority Leader William Will Barclay. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Looking back in history can often be a way to understand the present day. To that end, the new book, Progressive New York, Change and Reform in the Empire State, 1900 to 1920, published by SUNY Press, examines the catalysts for change at the beginning of the 20th century. Industrialization, immigration, growing wealth, along with the corruption of Tammany Hall, all contributed to calls for progressive change. But the movement came to a grinding halt by 1920. Author and editor Dr. Bruce Dierstein says there are definitely parallels to the state of American politics today.
Yeah, I think as this has come out about 6 months ago, it has seemed to me, as you were just implying, that there is a lot that we can learn from it today. The period, I think, right about the beginning of the time that I cover, up to about 1900, was a period of anxiety and stress. People were concerned about the accumulated problems from the 19th century, industrialization, urbanization, income inequality, and so on, and also the new technology, which in those days was cars, airplanes, and so on. And so a lot of what the progressives did, particularly here in New York, was to try to search for ways of dealing with this change, because the progressives were all about not accepting status quo, but making responsible changes in a gradual and pragmatic way. So there are lots of studies and reports and so on, which led eventually to some pretty substantial changes. One of the things that is in this, particularly in this new book, there is a fair amount of exhortation for individuals to change how they looked at things, for business people, leaders of industry, to change how they looked at things and accommodate workers and with better working conditions and wages more. And then, as sort of a last resort almost, turning to government. There's a lot in here about the advent of government regulation. So I think there is a similar anxiety today. I think we saw it play out in this recently completed election. And whether there will be now some sort of set of solutions which deals with the problems we're facing, I think we have to see. I think people are worried about things all the way from immigration to inflation and so on. And so we're at an inflection point, or hopefully a beginning point, of dealing with some of these issues in an effective way.
We're speaking with Dr. Bruce Dierstein. The book, Progressive New York, Change and Reform in the Empire State from 1900 to 1920. Before we go any further, let's give a definition. You know, progressive folks, progressivism, progressive reform, the idea of it seems to be we're not happy with the status quo, and in large part we want to raise the standard of living. But place that definition in that time frame we're talking about, 1900 to 1920.
Yeah, I start out with a broad definition, which is people in groups who are dissatisfied with the status quo, thought we could do better, and we're determined to improve it. It's confusing because it was also a progressive party. Only 1 year, as it turned out, 1912. There have been progressive parties since then, and some folks today, like Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Elizabeth Warren, are characterized as being a progressive. And in a sense, they all have a kinship and similarity. But folks today are different in the sense that they think more about a federal government intervention and so on. In the period I'm talking about, a lot of the action was with the states. So it's about a perception that we can do better and a desire to bring about some change in the right direction. But the folks I write about were not revolutionaries. They were not going to defend the status quo, but they didn't want to overthrow it either. They were trying to make things better for average people, trying to rein in some of the excesses of the era. For instance, if a lot of your listeners may have been following the Gilded Age on television, well, that's the way about some of the country, at least, saw New York City around 1900. But contrasted with that, there were some very poor areas in New York City, and New York was very diverse and changing all the time. For instance, there were a lot of immigrants coming in 1907. Over a million immigrants came into New York, to New York City. So the progressives tried to kind of rise above all that, take all of it into account, tried to reconcile things, tried to criticize the extremes on both sides, radicals who wanted to overthrow things and bring in something entirely new, and ultra-conservatives who didn't want to make any change at all. So if this sounds complicated, that's because it was. And if you ask any of the folks that I write about or I quote in this book, they would have said, yeah, you think it's complicated. And if you had been here when we were actually going through it, you would have seen how complicated it is. I think they were also kind of patient. They knew it was going to take some time to make changes, and indeed it did.
Well, yeah, and it's, you know, they really believed in this sort of incremental change, right? Working within the system to hopefully get to change. But they also were plagued with their own biases, including racism and other things, anti-Semitism, for example, even among the progressives.
Well, fair to say, yes, there is some of that. Those two things are very hard to discern and measure, because some of the progressives, as we look back on them now, seem to hold contradictory views of things about human beings, equality, everyone's created equal, we can't have bias, we can't have anything of the sort, versus once in a while lapsing into racism, and I think not very often into anti-Semitism. Part of the answer to that question is, if you look at New York State, and particularly New York City, that was and probably still is the most diverse city in the country. And so you have a lot of Jewish immigrants coming in. You have black people moving up from the South. And I think you have in New York City more than most other cities, a spirit of accommodation and tolerance. You also find in New York at this time the growth of Harlem, the so-called Harlem Renaissance, a lot of creativity, artists, musicians, and so on. And you also find a further complicated story, I guess, in 1909, the NAACP, which is still around today, being founded in New York City. And a lot of New York progressives were among the founders.
That's author and editor Dr. Bruce Dierstein. The book, Progressive New York, Change and Reform in the Empire State, 1900 to 1920. It's published by SUNY Press. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustino. Chemung County has been the epicenter of a heated controversy that's made national headlines after the seizure of two wild animals living in a home in Pine City. WSKG's Natalie Abruzzo has more on the situation involving Instagram famous Peanut the squirrel and Fred the raccoon.
At a press conference Tuesday, Chemung County Executive Christopher Moss presented a timeline of events and some answers for the public as to what happened to a squirrel and raccoon living in a house in Pine City. The two wild animals were seized from the residence of Mark Longo and his wife during a home inspection on October 30th and euthanized the same day, according to a rabies report form obtained by WETM. The squirrel is alleged to have bitten a DEC civilian wildlife biologist through their gloves. Concern about rabies in both animals led to the decision to capture and euthanize them. The viral disease can incubate in both animals and humans through exposure from any open wounds or mucous membrane, and it can be fatal without proper treatment. The only way to test an animal for rabies is through its brain, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Here's Pete Buzzetti, director of the Chemung County Health Department.
According to the State Department of Health, there's a lot of data on rabies incubation, so the time between an exposure and when you have the disease, in humans and in our pets, dogs, cats, ferrets. That same scientific data doesn't exist for wildlife, thus rendering a confinement or isolation not applicable.
According to the CDC, 90% of rabies cases in the U.S. come from wild animals like raccoons. In this instance, both animals tested negative for the disease. The Chemung County Executive Christopher Moss says the County Health Department was in constant communication with the DEC, but was not the lead agency in the investigation.
The acting commissioner said that he would keep us in the loop. They've done a great job doing that to this point. So I would ask the public just to be patient, let them conduct their entire investigation, and then we'll see what they have to say at the end of the day. health department had nothing to do with the search, nothing to do with the search warrant, or et cetera. So I guess that's where we're at.
In a press release from the Police Benevolent Association of New York, which represents DEC employees, complaints about the Longo residence and the illegal operation of a wildlife sanctuary started at the beginning of the year. The couple, who own the wild animals, also own property that they call Peanuts Freedom Farm Animal Sanctuary. The squirrel was a social media star with hundreds of thousands of followers on Instagram. It is illegal in New York to keep a squirrel unless you are a licensed wildlife rehabilitator and will be releasing the animal back into the wild. Longo assured the DEC he released the squirrel, according to the press release. A review by the DEC of Longo's social media accounts showed the squirrel was still living in the home, and the couple had also taken in a raccoon. So the DEC searched the home with a warrant, and that led to the chain of events creating a firestorm of national news headlines and death threats to local county employees, according to the Chemung County executive. There are 5 licensed wildlife rehabilitators in Chemung County. As of this reporting, WSKG has been unable to reach the parties involved, including the Longos and state and local officials. The DEC's investigation into this matter is still in progress, according to the county executive. In Corning, Natalie Abruzzo for the New York Public News Network.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen to the Legislative Gazette anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2446 and join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York state government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.